Hey everybody, welcome to The Barbell Strikes Back. I'm your host again, James McDermott, and joining me today is Juan Pejot. Juan is a coach and an athlete at the Brooklyn Athletic Club, and he is the 2017 Kettlebell World Champion in the long cycle event. I'm super excited to catch up with my friend Juan and hear all about his experiences in kettlebells. Juan, how are we doing?
I'm doing fantastic, sir. It was a pleasure to be on the interview with you and catch up and just talk all things muscle and training. So,
I know it's been a little while. We caught up briefly, you know, before I hit record, and you know, we actually met at an Attitude Nation weightlifting seminar instructed by John North at Coliseum Strength and Conditioning several years ago, and it's just kind of crazy how time has flown by.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've had another kid since that point. Like, you know, just like, yeah, everything's just been fantastic.
So. Yeah, well, congratulations, you know, on growing the family.
Growing the family, yeah.
Yeah, I see on your Instagram all the time, you know, your kids are moving the kettlebells too. So it's clear that you're having a very positive impact on them. And they see you doing it and they're like, I want to swing that kettlebell and be fit and healthy.
So they've been going to competitions with me since day one. My first national competition, my daughter was with me and she was 17 months old or so. I mean, it's a whole parent talk, but yeah, it's basically like a year and a half old. And I recently posted a picture of like what the day that I won that event, me holding her and she's like a little tutu, barely like running around. And yeah, they've been in it since like the beginning. It's always been some part of their life.
Yeah. So they're just growing up in it. And it's amazing to see that, you know, like I've seen it a lot in CrossFit and in weightlifting, kids kind of growing up in the community and just the impact it has on them. It makes me think, you know, I really wish I had something available to me like that when I was growing up, because when I was growing up, it was completely different, you know, so many video games and movies and other things. And it's like, it would have been, I wonder what, you know, what I could have done, you know, had I grown up in a gym atmosphere and community.
I would have loved it. I mean, I grew up as a Puerto Rican kid in Brooklyn, New York. You know, all I would do was either play video games, maybe play handball with friends on the weekends. And in the summer, it was Little League time, you know, because that's just the thing that you did when you were a Puerto Rican kid growing up in Brooklyn. But yeah, I mean, like, I think about that too. Like, but all the things that we're exposing our kids to as far as, you know, like, my kids do skateboarding, they do parkour classes, they've gone to Brooklyn Boulders to do rock climbing, they're going to get them into breakdancing because I used to do it when I was in high school. You know, like, just a plethora of different things that I want to get them really exposed to see what they connect with. And if I could go back in time, that's one thing that I really wish I would have had the opportunity to do, you know, like explore martial arts and different types of movements.
Yeah, that's fantastic that you're getting involved in so many different things, like parkour. Like, do you, like when you take them to parkour, do you participate at all? Like, do you do any of that?
I try to get in every once in a while whenever the instructor lets me, if there's not enough, you know, too many kids. But for the most part, I try to hang back because I don't want them to pay more attention to me and the fact that I'm present there for them versus the instruction that the teacher has. So it's a great facility. I take them to Brooklyn Zoo in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and they love it there. The instructors are fantastic. And whenever we go, it's like they're just always welcome. They want to dive into all the activities, and it's a great environment.
That's fantastic. Hopefully when, you know, the world opens back up again, you'll be able to keep doing that. How has your training been during this whole lockdown? I mean, the nice thing about body weight and kettlebells is you can do it anywhere.
Oh, dude, I have a whole set of bells with me that I was able to bring. I'll show you a picture of it. I'll send it to you so you can have it. But I've got my own bells here from 20 all the way to 32 kilo in pairs, aside from some bands. And I have one of Christoph's shoulder rock maces with me too. So I'm able to get a pretty good variety of working whenever I have the chance here. But I think the transitions that we've been experiencing as far as like the shift in social dynamic and engagement, as far as accessibility of having gyms and everything available, it's definitely caused us as beings that want to move, that crave movement for the sake of nourishing ourselves, to have to adapt and be more creative with the tools that we have accessible to us, you know? Definitely like stepping bands around the handle of a kettlebell to make things a little bit more interesting has definitely been something I've been delving into.
Yeah, well, one positive thing that I see coming out of this, and you know, you can look at it two ways. You know, I'm you know, in the management of a big gym here in Albany, Albany CrossFit. I'm the head coach, And nice. Obviously you have your gym. So of course there's the fear, oh my goodness, everyone's going to get their own equipment and then not want to come back. But I think it's a fantastic thing. I think everybody should own some dumbbells and kettlebells and bands and things like that in their home, because we know life happens and you can't always make it to the gym. And what we want to do as coaches is make it so our athletes are sustainable. Like, can you do this on your own, or are you helpless? If you're helpless, I haven't done my job. You know, I'm trying to prepare you for life, to be able to go out there, swing that kettlebell or move that dumbbell safely, get the best workout of your day, and then we take our relationship to the next level. Well, what do you want to do next? You know, I think that's you got to have a growth mindset with all this.
Yeah. And athletes should have a level of autonomy where they feel like they can function regardless of the situation, regardless of the setting, regardless of what they have accessible to them. You know, it's not uncommon, you know, you're traveling, and what do you do? Like, if you're traveling, you're on vacation, are you going to miss your training? Are you going to get thrown off program because you don't have the usual equipment, the usual setting, the hype people around you? Or are you going to go in there with that mindset of, I need to continue thriving and work with whatever you have accessible to you? Even if it's a hotel gym, that's fine. Make it work. You know, maybe increase the volume, maybe play around with the intensity, to do different things accessible to you so that you can continue to grow.
Exactly. And then, you know, then you have that relationship with the coach, like, hey coach, here's what I got. What can I do?
Yeah, exactly. And keep you on your toes.
Yeah. And we're here to think on our feet. You know, as coaches, we're professional problem solvers. So we'll figure it out. We'll work with you and get you the best workout possible.
Absolutely.
Now, Juan, are you still, like, we did that seminar together, you know, back in the day, it's back in the day now, with the barbell snatch clean jerk, John North seminar. Did you continue your training on those lifts after that seminar?
I've delved into it a little bit. I was able to take some continuing work with coaches like Will Fleming and Quinn Hennock from Clinical Athlete. So I got a little bit more exposure to barbell work. I was generally surrounded by a lot of magnificent barbell athletes that are able to help me as far as getting some technique down. But would I be able to say I'd confidently step onto a platform and, you know, try to put 200 kilos over my head? I don't think I would. It's really been more an accessory thing to kind of, oh my God, I would love, that'd be amazing. but yeah, I think I've been implementing it more, I think, as a way to break up the monotony and the repetition of being a specialist in a specific sport, and still having a sense of relativity within the training parameters of what I need. So my sport, for the most part, has a lot of unilateral components to it. So having something that forces me to kind of stay in a sagittal plane, to work with heavier loads, work with intensities, are going to be a lot more than what I'm accustomed to doing. It definitely takes me out of my comfort spectrum so that I can now be a more versatile athlete. And also helps me when I need to complement things for other athletes that I'm coaching as well.
Yeah. Now, with that being said, in your actual prep for kettlebell competition, does the barbell play a role at all? Like, absolutely. Maybe I'm imagining at the beginning of a training cycle leading up to a competition, maybe it's more barbell heavy or something, and then it tapers off. Yes. Or how does it work?
So when I'm depending on how much time I have available to me before a competition, I do end up having like strict barbell strength cycles that I end up working with, for the sake of either breaking up some injuries that I might have developed and wear and tear, getting stronger, becoming more resilient, more resistant to the loads that I'm going to be working with. And I keep conditioning on the back end of the training cycle so that I can focus on getting stronger, maybe working some hypertrophy into the mix, just because at the end of the day, I don't think anybody complains about having bigger biceps.
But, no. It's all I've been doing during lockdown, just curls on curls.
Curls and push-ups and pull-ups, everything you get a hold of. But yeah, I definitely include a lot of barbell work for the sake of getting stronger, developing more hypertrophy, working on some imbalances. Dumbbell work also comes into play, just to still maintain a unilateral component, but also have a little bit of variety from what my hands and my body's accustomed to as far as the crashing, the gripping, everything associated with kettlebell training specifically. And then as I start getting closer to a competition, I'll start phasing out some of the barbell work and make it accessory versus primary work, and then start shifting into more specificity associated with the long cycle work that I would do. I'd still have barbell training in there, but I wouldn't be testing a 3RM if it's within the month prior to a competition, because I tend to work more in the power endurance element. And me testing that, it might not necessarily be the most prudent thing to do because of injury prevention.
Yeah. And now, like, you're doing things like deadlifts, back squats, strict presses, maybe some snatch and clean and jerk in there?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, I might do work off the blocks. I might be doing some variations of the classical lifts, But when it comes to clean, I might be going more for a power clean versus full clean. When it comes to squatting, I stick more to back squats and safety bar squats for the most part, just because of the transition that would have into the positions I would work with. The classic front squat with a barbell, like loaded axially in front of my body, doesn't really translate as well into the kettlebell lifts because of the posture that I end up adjusting to. So for me, for example, I have to create a lot of lumbopelvic stability and then get a little more kyphotic on my thoracic spine. And then that level of rounding that I end up achieving doesn't really carry over well when you start throwing a barbell in the front of my body. So direct axial loading, like a back squat or a safety bar squat, tends to feel a lot better for me when I'm doing things like that. And also it's a little less wearing on the flexibility elements of my hands. So if I'm thinking about like what my wrist can accommodate. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Now I'm wondering, like you had made something pop up in my head here. I've seen videos of you doing like jerks with the kettlebell. And obviously it's a vastly different style of technique. At least it looks like it for me, where you're leaning back quite a bit and the hips are shifting forward. How does it feel going into a barbell and doing a barbell jerk where you almost have to send the hips in a different direction and just organize your body differently? Is that a hard transition?
At first, it feels a little alien to me when I'm going. When I first started doing it without having the guidance of a barbell coach, of a weightlifting coach, or somebody who just generally would be able to make those necessary corrections, because the way that I rack when I'm doing kettlebell lifting is elbows dug into my iliac crest, so connecting onto my trunk, which is very different from having a barbell racked in the front of my body and dipping into my jerk with a barbell. So when I was first doing it, it felt extremely awkward. There was a lot more wear on my wrists. I wasn't able to generate enough power. My balance would be thrown off. It just felt like I felt useless, completely useless when it came to doing that. Then I was able to lean on some of my colleagues who were much better at barbell work, and also the education that I was able to get along with John North and Fleming and Hennock, whenever I was able to take a seminar, that made me feel more comfortable so that I can use those to build up more power on those kind of off-season type training cycles.
Now,
there is a little mechanical differences.
What's the purpose on loading the way that you do for a kettlebell jerk or push press, where it's, obviously the elbows are dug in and the bells are hugged tight to your body and you're leaning back.
Yeah.
And this is something that, every now and then, like in CrossFit programming, kettlebell push press or jerk will pop up. Yeah. And I know we try to teach it like we're teaching a barbell,
Yeah.
And is that an inefficient way to teach it when you're trying to move a kettlebell, or is it just another way? And what is the benefit of trying to get that leaned back position? And for anyone listening, what would be a good place for them to, other than maybe checking out your Instagram, to see like some kettlebell overheads, a good place for them to see what we're talking about?
Kettlebell Kings is a kettlebell brand that produces equipment, also has a lot of great content when it comes to looking at technique, and it coming from a different schools of thought when it comes to kettlebell lifting. If you're thinking about traditional hard style or kettlebell sport, I'm actually going to be contributing an article to them shortly so they can explain some of the training variables that I use.
So check out Kettlebell Kings on YouTube and look up the jerk or push press on there, and you'll see this movement that might look very foreign to a lot of us in CrossFit and weightlifting.
Yeah, with the positioning, it's very different because of the adjusting that I have to do to my spine in a sense. So like I think of it, it actually wasn't difficult for me to adopt the technique because it feels very similar to when I'm holding my children. So when I'm thinking about the way that I would hold my kids, early on when they were very small and I had to almost accommodate to protect them, I would actually round my back a little bit just for the sake of having a cradle onto my hip. And then having two of them, it felt natural. It felt like I was
rocking two bells.
So the same way that you would see a parent hold a child because they have to multitask with that free hand, that's very similar to what you're going to see in the rack position with a kettlebell. It's more efficient if you're thinking about the duration associated with kettlebell sport, because it is an endurance-based sport versus generating absolute power. I am able to do jerks with like 40 or 44 kilo bells, which are relatively heavy compared to what we compete with, which is usually between 24 and 32. But I'm thinking more about the longevity element of it. When I'm racking my bells in kettlebell sport, by stacking the elbows onto the iliac crest, I'm exerting a lot less effort, and I'm relying on my structure to have to hold the weight up versus me having to stay very rigid and possibly fatigue over time, because the sets are traditionally 10 minutes in duration if you think about the classic kettlebell lifts. Now with positioning, by hugging them closer to my body and having them stacked in front of me, and having everything stacked over my pelvis, I'm able to move my spine out of the way, get a little bit more kyphotic and kind of round my back a little bit. There was actually no level of hyperextension I experienced in my lower back. So my lower back is actually pretty stable when I'm doing this, especially because I'm doing a lot of deep breathing to kind of flush everything out. As I load the legs, the legs, my quads in particular, are taking a lot of the load to be able to generate that upward force. And I don't have as much shifting as what you would see traditionally in barbell lifting. So if you're thinking about how it pertains to being efficient kettlebell lifting for the sport of it, I think like being able to get that lean, make the adjustments of getting the elbows onto the hip, it makes you be able to last a lot longer. Because when I've seen weightlifters and CrossFitters try to do competitions, they're usually the first ones to fatigue a lot faster, and they don't last like for the long game, if you're thinking about it in that sense.
Yeah, I'm thinking like that last year at the CrossFit Games, they had a kettlebell shouldered overhead, and it was a fairly light one. And I believe the workout involved, I think it was rowing, kettlebell over the head, and then like some handstand walking. You know, the order of that could be incorrect, or there might be another move. But a lot of people were burning out on the shoulders. And of course, they're going to be trying to do, you know, whatever the sum of the reps is, as close to unbroken as possible, because they're racing. And it was just interesting to see the different styles out there on the field and who was able to last and who wasn't. Of course, there's the freak athletes who, no matter what they're doing, they're just going to blow right by it. But then there are other people who are kind of using that kettlebell style of just a little more of a lean back, hugging the weight to the chest and keeping the elbows tied in. So it makes a lot of sense. Is that something that should be taught, you know, to general CrossFitters when they're doing like a Metcon, or would it be better to go with maybe just the what feels natural and kind of holding it like a dumbbell?
I think that depends on the athlete. I do think that inclusion of kettlebell sport based techniques into a general CrossFit setting would be helpful, because at the end of the day, you're not using the same tools. Like the diameter of a barbell, the diameter or the dimensions of a dumbbell are not going to feel the same as when you're holding a kettlebell. And if you're presented in situations like where you're referencing at the games, where people had to specifically use a kettlebell regardless of the manufacturer, you're not ready to deal with that new variable, then the equipment dimensions, the diameter of the handle, the way that it sits on your palm, like all these different little things, all these little nuances, you have to consider them.
So the equipment definitely matters. And it matters with a barbell too. Yeah. So it makes sense that it matters here. And I know like we have the traditional Rogue bells, and I know from what I've seen at your gym, you guys have the competition style kettlebells where regardless of the weight, they're all the same height.
Exactly.
And shape. Yes. And that's incredible. I think that's very valuable to have.
Well, it's great for reducing the learning curve so that you end up having everybody be able to learn on the same format. I like the level of consistency you can experience regardless of wherever your training is, whether you're going to be in Belgium or in Boston, you're going to have the same dimensions accessible to you. I like that the progressions are consistent. You don't have to adapt to a new size, like you mentioned with the Rogue bells. They're great as far as like what the design elements of it is and the feel of it and the matte finish and everything else. But at the end of the day, an 8 kilo bell is going to be a lot smaller than what a 40 kilo bell is. And if you're working your progressions, that's you're not only adapting to the change in load, but you're also adapting to the change in what the feel of the equipment is in your hand and against your body.
Oh, yeah.
Just something in sport you don't have to experience.
Yeah, I know when we're teaching kettlebells, just to swing, you know, you got some bigger guys and they need to use a lighter bell, but they can't fit their hands in the handle.
Yeah, exactly.
That's always like a tough part. And then they got the pinkies hanging off.
Yeah. Which even with the pinkies, like there's like little hacks you can do with that just to make you a little more efficient, like pressing the pinky into the corner, which you don't have enough room. I mean, like, what are you going to do? You know, that's why like the wider handles end up being very helpful.
We used to, back in the day, have a complete set of competition bells. And it's actually funny. Those were the ones that everyone steered clear of because they didn't look like the sexy Rogue bells. That, you know, just had a different look. It looks meatier. And, you know, you would go to pick up, you know, like a very light one, expecting it to be heavier than it was. And then you'd rip it up off the floor
and fly
up. I wish that we still had that set. I think it'd be a very valuable teaching tool. I think if I was going to outfit my gym with kettlebells, maybe competitive type kettlebells would be the way to go.
Oh, they definitely would be, yeah. And Kings, which I mentioned before, they manufacture really beautiful bells, and they have really good wear to them. Their durability is amazing on the bells. I think a reason why some some gyms don't like the use of competitive bells is because you have that lack of uniformity as far as the color scheme. It might not go with the background that they have going on. When they wear and the paint starts chipping away, they tend to look on the older side. I personally don't like I don't mind the look of weathered equipment. It kind of tells a story. So
rustic equipment. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. But then you look at Rogue or Aider or any of these brands that are out there. They make everything look very neat, very matte, black. Everything looks very, very consistent, which looks great. It looks marketable to the uneducated athlete, the uneducated gym goer who hasn't really earned the use of the equipment yet. But as soon as they start playing around with it and they start getting a feel for it, then it's completely different. I tend to prefer coaching somebody with a competitive bell because the increased surface area makes it where you have less impact on a specific spot. So you end up having a better distribution along the forearm, along the arm. Cleans are a little easier to learn. Snatches are a little easier to learn. And truthfully, if somebody has a bad experience because they're constantly banging their forearm or banging their shoulder, they're not going to want to really connect with that piece of equipment.
Oh yeah, the snatch becomes a feared movement as opposed mm-hmm. to a fun one, which we want to be having fun every time we're in the gym.
Exactly.
Now let's switch gears here a little bit. You mentioned something earlier, and I think I've seen this in some of your videos. You also have the maces or the clubs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other sport in itself, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's some federations that do. They do odd object competitions so there's 8X and other brands that they end up producing maces of varying weights. The competitive lifts are very similar, 10 minutes in duration. And what you're contesting is a classic 10 to 2 mace variation where you're basically swinging it behind your head. You have to stop right in front of you for a second to then swing back in the other direction.
How much does it weigh typically?
I think anywhere between 12 and 18 pounds. But they do end up doing subdivisions within body weight and within the weight of the actual mace itself, the way they would do with kettlebell lifting. So we have weight categories and of body weight, as well as the weight divisions of the weight that you're competing with, which makes you eligible for either a master of sport rank or a candidacy for master of sport or ranks 3-1 that just give you more experience along the way. So with maces, I haven't delved too much into the competitive element of it, but I've been present when they're doing a lot of the competitions and I've talked with some of the athletes. And it's a very interesting dynamic if you're looking at the way that everything's contested. It's not a raw strength element. It's finesse. There's a lot of finesse behind them, techniques.
So the kettlebell is like endurance, and then mace is maybe more of like a finesseful thing. I love that there's this underground community of different types of strength sports and different implements. I kind of wish it was something that was more popular. Like just. Heavy dumbbell lifts, watching people lift heavy dumbbells and do the old timey lifts. And I guess strongman kind of does that, but I think more maybe traditional style of what used to happen back in the day, there needs to be some sort of a revival with that. And who knows, maybe the way the world is going with everyone having this equipment now in their homes, it'll maybe start to beef up. Someone's got to take the reins on that.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't that long ago that most people didn't know what weightlifting was. It didn't have the level of exposure it has now, and it was viewed as this foreign lift, because traditionally people were used to either a step aerobic class or going in and the stereotypical athlete was a bodybuilder, and if you were a male and you wanted to get stronger, you were a bodybuilder. Powerlifting was looked down upon, weightlifting was looked down upon, strongman, God forbid, and now these are leading the charge as far as a fitness revolution in the sense, where people are focusing more on performance, on strength, on optimization of who they are as beings and having a whole holistic effect versus just having a six pack, or just eating broccoli and tilapia, all day, which is nothing wrong with that. But now there's a universal respect for varied sports now.
Yeah. Having done the broccoli and tilapia route in the early days, like 2007, 2008, 2006, it's not the most enjoyable life to live.
definitely.
It's good the world has changed for in some things, and people are starting to learn more. And we've learned so much over the past decade plus. Now, with competitive kettlebelling, is there one big organization? Are there many organizations? I know at times I've tried to find kettlebell competitions, and it seems like a difficult sport to find events for. Maybe this was years ago, so maybe it's more prevalent now.
There are several federations right now that globally that do conduct competitions. So one of the major competitive bodies is the International Union of Kettlebell Lifters, which is composed of about 34 different countries, mostly European, and they host their world championships every year. You have the World Kettlebell Sport Federation. There's the International Kettlebell Marathon Federation. There's a few different ones that are out there. There isn't one unified body though, which I think definitely makes it where inclusion into bigger events like say possible Olympic event later on down the line makes it very difficult because there isn't unification within all these different federations. But for the most part, the standards as far as competitive judging are pretty consistent all the way through as far as the fixation you have to have while overhead, making sure that there's a level of stillness that's exhibited. The rules as far as etiquette and performance with technique, like all these things are pretty consistent along the way. The variances that you might see is within the ranking tables. So like the way I mentioned Master of Sport is the title that's achieved after years of training, though the quota ends up adjusting from one federation to another. So me, I usually compete in the 78 kilo bodyweight division. And in one federation, I might need to perform 53 repetitions of clean and jerk with a pair of 32 kilos in a 10-minute bracket. Another federation might only require me to do 48, whereas another federation might ask for 56. And a prep from one to another has to be very particular, because unless you happen to just be a very superb athlete and you can hit the higher numbers on call. But yeah, I mean, right now there is still a movement of kettlebell lifting and from a competitive state as far as training. And there's a lot of, it's a community that for the most part, the training has always been performed in a bit of a solitary manner. You know, you have garage athletes and people who are in their homes and doing things. There aren't as many kettlebell clubs accessible because, you know, it's still a relatively underground sport for the most part. It's not like barbell lifting where barbell clubs are prevalent in every CrossFit box you find and even some big box gyms. And also it's a very niche sport where you do have to have somebody available to be to teach those elements, to teach those technique differences. And you can't just be very, very proficient in barbell lifting and immediately assume that's going to carry over into the kettlebell lifting.
Yeah, I think that's something where maybe in time, again, people will gain that understanding, because there was a point where weightlifting experienced the same thing. You know, these are difficult movements that need instruction from someone who knows what they're doing and has an eye for the technique and keeping the body healthy. I think that would be fantastic to have kettlebell sport in the Olympics someday. It kind of seems like it's very, very close that all these federations could kind of maybe, all right, I'll lay down my sword on this. We'll do 55 reps here. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll all be friends and we'll get in the Olympics. And that would be something that would probably blow the sport up a little bit. It kind of like needs like just like that one, you know, big push out into the limelight.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be fantastic to see. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the sport here. So you are involved in soft style or hard style? Are those even things? That's just the extent of what I know.
Absolutely. Hard style is what you would categorize as the teaching of instructors like Pavel Satsaludin and what the Russian Kettlebell Certification and Strong First and everybody teaches. Very tension based. A lot of isometric contractions. Yeah, their goal is usually to within a shorter period of time lift a heavier weight, and there's a lot more focus on rigidity. Now, when you're looking at kettlebell lifting, it is referred to as soft style, not so much because of it being an easier practice, but because there's a sense of relaxation and an emphasis on breathing that you have to focus on in order to be able to endure through the duration of the sets that are competitive in nature. So the way that you would do a 5-minute snatch test for Strong First or RKC is not going to be performed the same way that a 10-minute snatch set would be performed in a competitive level.
That's 10 minutes of continuous kettlebell snatching.
Oh, yes.
Trying to get as many reps as possible.
Yeah. So if you're doing a competitive snatch, then you, whatever hand you want to start out with, it could be your stronger hand, it could be your weaker side. You get as many repetitions as you can. You're allotted one hand switch. And then when you switch hands, you do whatever amount of repetitions you can on that second hand. And you have 10 minutes to do as many as you can, or as more than the other guy, or whatever the quota ends up being for you in that day.
And you put it down, you're done.
Yeah, no, literally. If you're 1 minute in and you drop the bell, that's your set.
Oh man, all right, yeah, I like that. I like that part about this event, because it's like do you want it or not? You know, you want to go for one more kettlebell swing or kettlebell snatch or not?
Oh, it's so gladiatorial. I love it. I love the sets. I mean, it definitely weeds out the ones who really want it, who really want to fight for it, who took the time to prep for it, who are really like vested into what they're doing.
Well, what's your record on that event? And do you have any good battle stories of like where you're just slugging it out with another guy or a bunch of guys?
Oh God, yeah. So my best clean and jerk set has been 53 reps in competition, and I've done 55 reps in training with a pair of 32 kilos, weighing 78 kilos on the lighter set and weighing 81 kilos roughly on the higher set of 55.
For anyone listening, the 32 kilos for our pound people is 70 pounds about.
Yes, 70 pounds per hand.
So you're holding, and you're in the 78 kilo class, so you're holding quite a bit of weight and going for 10 minutes?
Yeah, I'm holding what I guess like 82% of my body weight at that point. So the sets are 10 minutes in duration. When I begin the set, I cannot put the bells down because like you mentioned before, that terminates a set. You do get a score, but it obviously cuts your possibilities. So 53 in competition, 55 in training with 32 kilo bells. I haven't competed in snatch, but my best 24 kilo snatch numbers end up being 210 reps within a 10 minute bracket.
Holy crap. And that's a 53 pound kettlebell about.
53 pound kettlebell. Yeah. Just a single swing. I mean, I was done. I was definitely fried at the end of that one, but 210 is my top on that. And as far as battle stories got, I broke a platform, which was an interesting one. And it was, nice. I think the year before we met, actually, now that I think about it, I was competing where at the old CrossFit LIC in Queens, that Vadim Noskov used to own. And we were doing a set under the American Kettlebell Alliance. And it was probably my third time competing with 32 kilos. And I just like gave it my all. I was competing against a teammate of mine, actually, named Rick Martins. And you know, he hit a certain number. He ended up dropping. And I was like, I'm not going to lose this guy. I love him. He's my brother, but I'm not going to lose. So I just kept on going until I was able to beat him. And I beat him by one. But that last rep, when I came down, I literally collapsed with the bells. And you had a pair of 32 kilos goes right through the platform. So it definitely had like a Mjolnir driving into the ground kind of feel to it. And I think there's the memes that go around the internet still about that day. So me looking up and laughing and like apologizing for having broken a platform.
How do they come back from that? Like, cause there's probably more events, right? They probably just got to get out there and get some more.
Yeah, they shifted platforms. They took that one out. I think since then they don't use an elevated plywood platform because of the possibility of something crashing through it. So now they just did more layering on the panel to be able to reinforce it.
So look at that. You changed the sport.
I contributed.
Yeah, you made them, you know, with their platform creation, be a little bit more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's and you got a meme out of it too. Not everyone's got a meme floating out there. You'll have to find out.
I'll find it. I'll send you the original pictures also.
Yeah. So with that's endurance style kettlebell. Are there strength kettlebell events where it's like as heavy as possible? I know the heaviest kettlebell I've ever seen was 92 kilos. It was on Glenn Penley's front porch, and he said that only a handful of people, including himself, maybe three people, have picked it up and pressed it over their head. I did a couple of deadlifts with it and felt good about myself. But it was like,
great.
Is there any like big strength type things?
Well, there still is a strongman style or strength style competitive lifting and with kettlebells where you have like the 92 or 80 kilo are still contested. It's like a whole separate branch within the same tree, I guess you could say.
Is that where the big guys go and the heavyweight athletes?
Yeah, I mean, you have both. I mean, like we have 95 plus athletes, we have 100 kilo plus athletes coming in, which, you know, like I've seen 260 pound guys clean and jerking pair of 32s, like, you know, like handbags. I mean, they looked light, putting up numbers like 120 reps within 10 minutes. So you still see like large athletes performing in that sense. But the stronger athletes, I think that the, if I'm not mistaken, within the origins of kettlebell lifting, it was something within that avenue of, you know, I can do more than you. And it was just like farmers who happen to, you know, just want to see who's tougher than the other. And it was an agricultural tool at the beginning, regardless. And, you know, it could have been that me and you were at the market and I wanted to see who can get bragging rights. And I'm going to put this 53 pound bell over my head more times than you can, or you're going to get that 80 kilo overhead and I can't. You know, so it became a bragging rights thing. You know, who gets the chance to talk a little
bit? Like the essence of sport, right there. Yeah. Who are some of the, like, I know in weightlifting, like Pocket Hercules and Pyrrhus Dimas, you know, are like our big guys. Who are some of the, like, the legends in the sport? And are there any of them that they just did such incredible feats that it's just never been touched since?
Yeah, I'd say that one of the top guys I can think of off the top of my head is Ivan Denisov. He's the absolute world champion across the board in every discipline with every weight. When I mentioned the 120 rep clean and jerk, he's the one who holds that record. I don't think he's been able to touch it since that one time. But even then, like, his bad sets are still better than most of other people's good sets. His snatch numbers, I think, are somewhere like 226 reps with a 32 kilo bell. Jerk numbers are like 175 reps of just continuous jerk with no re-clean. So yeah, he's definitely like the guy to watch if you wanted to watch like a really impressive lift.
So no clean on that one, just bringing it down to the shoulders and going right back up.
Yeah. Well, that's where, like, you have to, like, aside from your lung capacity, you have to have, like, very endurant legs, you know, be able to get that much pop for that duration of time. I find the continuous jerk to be harder than the re-clean element with a long cycle. I favor that because you do get a chance to breathe and rest and unload the weight from your body, even though it is more taxing on your grip because you do have to be able to pull the weight back up into the rack position. Another
great. Yeah, I can't imagine that. That would be like, brutal. I mean, like, not that the weights are completely equivalent, you know, because there are other factors, but like, imagine for anyone listening, holding a 140 pound barbell on your chest and doing over 100 reps without putting down the bar. Like, it's, I don't know if anyone could do that. That sounds insane.
It's brutal. I had one of the guys that I was coaching who was actually, he's a very talented CrossFit athlete. Hadn't done weightlifting, I think, at the time, but really, really strong athlete named Julio Gutierrez. And when he didn't have access to any competitive bells, he would just grab 135 on a bar and just do as many clean and jerks unbroken as he could. You know, he'd get like 25, 30 continuous reps and then put him down, take a walk, come back, hit another set.
So he would do a CrossFit workout, Grace.
And then just
walk it off and do it again.
Yeah.
Which is the last thing you want to do.
Volume. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, let's dive more into your competitive history here. First, I want to talk about this. The Arnold. Were you at the Arnold?
Yeah, I was at the other
Yeah. Yeah, I was there. I was there too for the weightlifting event. I had no idea you were out there. I know. Had I known, you know, we would have tried to meet up.
Oh,
you know,
man, would have linked up, grabbed a beer or something. Yeah.
Yeah. A small world, you know, like, but, you know, so much craziness was going on with that whole trip, you know, and everything starting to get shut down and everything. But so how was that? How was the Arnold? How'd you do? Did you get to see Arnold? You know, did he pop in?
No. There's a chance he might have popped in when I was in the middle of a competition, but I get tunnel vision when I'm competing and I can't see anything, like, aside from the clock that's in front of me and whatever, and my judge. So if he came in at some point when I was doing the relay competition, that might have happened, but I didn't hear anything about that. Arnold's was interesting. I drove out there with two teammates of mine, my buddy Carter Berry and Bobby Hicks, and it was a really fun 9-hour drive, you know, from New York all the way to Ohio.
That was a little rough drive.
yeah, but you know what, like, it was fun. I mean, I'd rather that than just be stuck on a plane and just, like, there was just too much going on at the time. You know, I figured, like, we can keep control of the situation by driving out there. And it was my first time going to the Arnold's. So I guess I didn't experience, like, the hype that everybody tends to brag about, you know, that we're shoulder to shoulder within a crowd and there's so many vendors and people in your face.
It wasn't us too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I got there, we weighed in, everything came out great. I weighed in at 81 kilos, and I was in the 85 kilo weight division. I wasn't trying to go too light on that day. Then my competitive set, I didn't hit a PR. I was having issues with my grip fatigue while I was there. So that's probably a training variable I just hadn't addressed properly throughout the time while I was getting ready for that. But my grip fatigued on me, so I ended up dropping a bit early. It was one of those situations where, like, I didn't compete as well as I had trained. My training sets were a lot better, which made me get frustrated immediately. But I redeemed myself the next day when we signed up for a relay event, which we did a team relay where it was a United States team against a Ukrainian team against a mixed countries team, where I think we were competing with a pair of 24 kilo bells, and we were doing 2 minute interval relays where you would go for 2 minutes, clock out, your partner goes in, and everybody gets I think a duration of like 6 minutes of rest in between the sets before your next person goes in. But yeah, I mean, with
that's pretty cool that you can sign up for multiple events at the competition. Just like, oh, hey, we're here. Let's do this as well. You know, versus like for weightlifting, it's like, nope, you're locked in. And really the only thing we're doing is snatch and clean and jerk. That team element is pretty cool.
I love it, actually. And the team element, because of the aggression behind it, because of the intensity behind it, that's what drew in a lot of the crowd. So we had, we were actually right across from a room that had a powerlifting federation competing. So we would have all the powerlifters and some of the strongmen kind of peeking in to see what was going on, because all they heard was like metal clanging and grunting and chalk flying through the air. And they're like, oh, well, there's a sense of camaraderie here. This feels familiar, but it's different. Let's go take a look at what's going on. And that's really what drew the crowd, because to be honest, the traditional kettlebell sets in 10 minutes in duration, the first part of it feels like you're watching paint dry. And then it's the last couple of minutes of the set where you've seen, you know, the people who are not able to last to the very end, you know, they get knocked off, and you have the real fight happening in the last like 2 minutes of it. So yeah, like the relay ended up being really, really fun. And yeah, like, you know, you said you can sign up for multiple events. If I was going in, I could do multiple events, but I would still have my focal point if it was like a qualifier that I was going for. If I wanted to go for a particular rank, if I wanted to get a personal best or anything like that. So you could sign up for clean and jerk. You could do your biathlon at the same weight or a lighter weight. You could do a team relay. You could do a marathon event where you're doing it for 30 minutes or an hour of continuous switches, which that's like a whole other world in a sense, you know.
So with the marathon, you've mentioned that a couple times. Is the marathon mainly a team event, or is that individual as well?
No, you can go into it as individual. So I would basically be up there. Let's say I'm doing a half marathon. I would be doing a 30-minute set. I would have a chalk bag or a chalk bucket beside me so I can do re-chalking of my hands. And when I'm doing it, I'm going for continuous hand switches if I'm doing a clean jerk, or if I'm doing a snatch, or if I'm doing a jerk. And I'm able to re-chalk, and I might have a partner or a coach beside me who gives me water or maybe helps me with chalk or whatever I may need. But the goal is to get as many repetitions as you can within a 30-minute allotted period of time. And then that'll qualify you to potentially compete on a larger scale if you're going to go internationally. Most of these competitions end up being in Europe for the most part. Like IKMF, I think they had their championships in Spain recently. But yeah, it's the same lifts performed in the same manner, but you do have the ability to be able to consistently switch back and forth. No, there's no putting down. That's the thing. Like that's the killer with any of these kettlebell lifts. Like, yeah, you start, you finish, you can't put them down in between.
Okay, so you're going for 30 minutes. You can switch hands on the snatch as many times as you want. Yeah. And while you're snatching on the right side, someone can be squirting water into your mouth and chucking you a chalk ball for your left hand. And then you switch. Can you pause with it overhead?
Yeah, you can. You can hang out overhead as long as you want. Obviously, that affects you in how many repetitions you can get done. But yeah, if you're snatching, you can hold overhead for 2 seconds, 5 seconds, 20 seconds, whatever you need, because that's the only moment of legal stillness. So if I was doing a snatch, I can stop overhead. I could take as long as I need to rest and then go into my next rep. If I'm doing clean and jerk, I can rest in my rack position. I can rest in the overhead position. And then the same with the jerk. What I can't do is a dead stop where I'm hanging with the bells underneath my pelvis and then bucking the weight to be able to get them back into rack. So it has to be a continuous flow, or pausing in rack or overhead.
Wow, so 30 minutes. What's your record on that one?
Oh God, what did I do one time? A pair of 24 kilos. I didn't like the idea of the hand switching, so I was like, oh, you know, let me see if I can be tough, you know. And I stayed with a pair of doubles. I was moving at a rate of 6 reps a minute for 21 minutes roughly, and I was able to get something about 126 reps within 22 minute period or so. So yeah, I guess 121 reps, I believe, with a pair of 24 kilos.
So you're trying to time it out 6 reps a minute. Do you use like EMOMs or every minute on the minute sets in your training to kind of prepare for something like this?
Yeah, we could. for the most part, everything is going to be other mixed duration sets. So I might do intervals where I'm doing minute on, minute off worth of work, trying to get as many reps as possible, as long as I'm trying to keep a consistent rep scheme. So I wouldn't want to go too fast at the beginning and then start dying down and then fail my numbers, because at the end of the day, I have a total volume I want to be able to hit. So my intervals would be coming into play at one portion. I might be having like middle range duration where I might be doing 3 to 5 minutes with 3 to 5 minutes worth of rest in between, doing that for 2 to 3 minutes, 2 or 3 repetitions. Or I could just do a longer set with lighter duration weight where I'm working on another technique or just endurance over time. But yeah, we have done like every minute on the rimit. We've done AMRAP and concepts. It's helpful, you know, when it's like those off season kind of training sessions.
So you're 6 reps every minute, and probably at certain points or like the majority of the minute after you get those 6 reps done, what it probably takes like what, like 40 seconds to do about 6 reps, because you're probably pausing a little bit overhead or so.
Yeah. Well, right now, if I was a clock, if I'm looking at a descending clock and I'm trying to get 6 reps every minute, what I would do is I would go for the bump of the jerk on every 3 of a second coming down. So at 53, 43, 33, and so on, that's when I would hit my jerk to make sure that I have enough time overhead to get a legal rep, a legally fixated rep, which is about a half second to a second of stillness before coming down to repeat the cycle of the repetition.
That do they tell you down to bring it down and do another one, or do they just not count it if it's not a good rep?
Well, they'll give you a no count, where you'll see that there won't be a change on the timer, and they'll notify you by either holding a hand up and or doing some kind of gesture saying no rep.
And do better so on the usually, next one.
Yeah, do better on the next one. You're allowed 3 chances to be able to get no reps. On the third one, they'll just terminate your set at that point. So you can recover from a no rep, but you just have to make sure it doesn't throw you off your game when you're in the middle of it. I've just seen it happen a lot of times.
Well, what I really like about that too is the way you're timing it out is to do this event, you also need, you know, not only strength and conditioning, but you need a high level of patience too.
Yes.
You know, and I know I see it in weightlifting, you know, someone at a meet, they get the weight up on their shoulders and maybe they go for the jerk a little too fast. You know, they didn't get set up all the way. They didn't take a breath in, and they just need like an extra half a second before doing the jerk. So I like that you're able to execute that high level of patience in your lifting to keep getting to the next level.
Well, I mean, patience is the name of the game when it comes to continuously winning, when it comes to continuously growing. You know, it's not going to happen. The progress of becoming from novice to champion wouldn't happen overnight. So you have to think about in that moment when you're in the midst of a competition, when there's like a lot on the line because you spent so much time preparing for it. If you spent all this time prepping for something, why are you going to rush that moment that you could achieve that goal that you've been fighting so hard for? If you're spending the last 6 to 8 months of your life dedicated to this one moment, why rush it? You know, just savor it. Make sure that you're experiencing it the way it should be.
I love that. It's just I'll relate it to a weightlifting meet. Instead of, you know, you get 1 minute to go out there and do that lift, don't just beeline it right to the bar and rush your lift and then
one beeline minute's a long right ass off. Time. You know, like you'd be surprised how much you can get done in that 1 minute. Make sure you have your setup. Make sure that everything, like all your dominoes are in line before you go for it.
Yes, especially coming from kettlebell sport, your perspective on time is so much different than weightlifting for sure. And then also like CrossFit, because I mean, CrossFit, a lot of things are for time, but doing 10 minutes of continuous clean and jerks with 270 kilo or 32 kilo bells, that's different. It's a little different of an animal.
Yeah, definitely.
And it makes a lot of sense though, you know, because you are a champion. Did you win the Arnold? What was the result of the Arnold?
No, I didn't. I came in third place in the Arnold, but I ended up qualifying for the national team regardless.
Oh, cool!
And so that. But then the World Championships ended up getting suspended because of everything that we're experiencing right now with COVID-19. So it was supposed to be in Madrid, Spain, and it would have been June 10th through the 14th, I believe. So right now we just have to see what happens as far as what the new parameters are going to be when it comes to social gatherings and athletic events and everything else. I mean, if the Arnold's is any example of what it was when it was kind of like in a good stage, then, I guess we'll see. We'll see what the cards hold.
Yeah. I mean, well, we'll just have to be patient, you know, and see what happens. But let's bring it back to the Worlds that you have done. Was that the 2017 Worlds, was that your first Worlds and only Worlds, or are you a multiple time world champion? And I know there's a story behind how you got there, right? Like, Like, was it a last minute decision or something like that? Let's dive into that.
Well, first time I competed at Worlds was 2013. And that was the first time I also went to Russia. And it's the only time I've gone to Russia, but we traveled to Tumen, which is, my understanding is as far east as you can go before you start going into like Siberian borders. But I went to Tumen and I competed on the amateur level. I ended up winning a gold medal in the amateur division while I was there. I went back for 2 years after that. Was it 2 years? No. 1 year afterwards, I competed then again in Hamburg, Germany, still on amateur level. And the next year, I went to Dublin, Ireland. It was the first year I competed professionally, and that would be 2015. And then 2016 is when I decided not to go to that particular federation's world championships because I wanted to prep for 2017, which 2017 was actually held in Costa Mesa, California by another organization. It was the World Association of Kettlebell Sport Clubs. And like, I've thrown a couple names out there because there's so many different federations. But when I went to that
the world championship itself, it can bounce around from federation to federation. Yeah. And if you are the world, if you win the world title on one federation, the others will recognize you.
Well, if you have a world title in one federation, it doesn't necessarily mean it carries over into the other one because you might have an athlete within each respective weight division, within each respective federation who holds a title, and the reps might be different. You can have those two people duke it out if necessary. But when it comes to these federations, it depends on, you know, which one you end up showing up for and being able to perform at your best for. So when I competed at the WAKSC, the World Association of Kettlebell Sport Clubs, that was 2017 in Costa Mesa in California. And that was a great event because it was national teams that came from different countries to be able to gather. And it was interesting. I actually was competing against my old coach who lives in St. Petersburg, Russia. And he, I think, hadn't competed for a couple of years. When he jumped back into it, he competed with 32 kilos also beside me. And I ended up beating him, you know, which was like a big like uproar for me. But that was the last time that I won like a world championship event. And it was the first time and only time I've won it as a professional, whereas the other time that I won it in the amateur level within a different division.
You are an amateur world champion a few times.
In one division.
And then a professional world champion in another division.
Another federation. Yes.
What was that like going up against your old old coach? And did you bust out any Star Wars lines about, you know, like, once I was the learner, now I'm the master, whatever the quote is?
I wish I would have had the chance to do that. We were just so caught up in the emotions and then everything was going on. It was great. I mean, I hadn't seen him probably about a year and a half since the last time that he had visited the States for a seminar that I hosted for him. But it was great. I have a lot of love for the guy. He's an amazing person, spectacular father, entrepreneur, a very intelligent man. And
what's his name again?
His name is Arseny Zernikov, and he has a brand called Lab of Champions. So he basically manufactures weightlifting belts for kettlebell sport, weightlifting shoes for kettlebell sport. He also started diving into making shirts that have specific traction in areas like in the trunk and the shoulders, to help you with not slipping off.
That's a good idea.
Have a better rack position. Yeah, no, it's really interesting stuff. Like I think he's definitely become a pioneer when it comes to like the accessory gear that you would use, you know, and being very innovative in the way that he's designing all of his equipment.
Yeah, that seems I didn't even think about that, where you might be wearing one of those like slick Under Armour shirts. And
those are horrible.
Your forearms are sliding all over your torso. It may look cool, but you can't hold on to the kettlebells.
Yeah, you look buff, but you're slipping all over the place. Any kind of moisture wicking shirt that you would wear, it's a hindrance. I mean, you're gonna be sliding all over the place. You can't wear a weightlifting belt that has too high of a back to it, because then the assumption is that you're cradling your spine against the belt and you're using it as an unfair advantage. You can't wedge your elbows on the inside of the front of your belt, because then you're using it as a block to keep your elbows from falling down, versus demonstrating proper rack technique. His decision to make gear for the sport of kettlebell lifting, they made it where we were just having an advantage over other people who were just kind of going in there raw, in a sense. Going back to that competition, it was a great experience. It was the first time I got through an entire 10-minute set at a professional level. That day, my reps were 51 reps. So I made 51. That got me my Master of Sport title, which is like the equivalent of a black belt within the span of kettlebell lifting. And yeah, I was able to stand toe-to-toe against my old coach, have a great time with him. We had a beer right afterwards, jumped into a relay right after that. It was phenomenal. But I think that would be like my favorite competitive experience out of anyone that I've had.
It sounds phenomenal. Yeah. And yeah. What is your approach to your competition mindset in a scenario like that? So you're going in, there's gotta be nerves, but like you said before, you have the tunnel vision. What kind of a competitor are you? Are you like getting all hyped up? Are you very cerebral and just focused? Like what are some things that you do?
I try to zone out as quickly as I can when I'm starting my preparation. So I'll tend to whoever I need to tend to and have whatever conversation I have to up until the point of 90 minutes prior to my competitive set. So I can start doing my mobilization, start doing my activation work, start doing anything that I need to physically prep for it. And then I actually start watching videos and listening to audios of my kids, you know, to soothe me, to put me in a very positive place. And I've always felt as if they've been a very supportive element in my life. I start watching videos of my wife. Maybe I'll have a conversation with them depending on what the time zone is and where I am. And then I say that in the minutes prior to it, when I'm doing like my warm-up sets and I'm trying to really, really prime myself to dial in for the competitive set, then I'll start listening to more aggressive music. So I might throw on a little Godsmack, a little Disturbed, and just play around with that for the sake of really getting amped up so I can jump into my set. I think it's a matter of reminding myself why I'm fighting. And then at the same time, I shift into these are the things that are going to get me really aggressive so that I can go in there and just like execute and just do what I got to do.
And just let it out. Do you use that during your set? Like maybe you're getting tired, your grip's starting to go. You're like, man, I don't know if I can get another couple reps. I really want to put this kettlebell down. And then like, do you have images of your family flashing in your head and be like, no,
absolutely.
Get one more for them, you know, one more for each of them.
Yeah, I've done that. I think of 2013 when I won my first national championship. I couldn't hear anything going on in the competitive set. I couldn't hear the music. I couldn't hear the bells falling around me. I couldn't hear people yelling at me, giving me cues. But I could hear my daughter, who was, again, she was like 18 months at the time. And I could hear her yelling, daddy up, daddy up. And that just like, I dialed into that moment and that helped me. There's another time when she's eight now. So maybe she was like, I'm going to say like 6, 5 years old. I took her to a competition with me and I could hear her yelling and screaming and being my little cheerleader. And that was helpful. I think about my son, you know, and the way that like, he'll sit there and he'll just watch me and he's like studying everything that I'm doing almost as if he's like telepathically giving me cues. They're definitely like big helpers. I think of, you know, what type of example am I setting for them? You know, if I drop, but I knew I had still something in me, am I teaching them to give up on themselves at the same time? You know, like what type of champion do I want them to be within the scope of whatever they want to accomplish? And it doesn't have to be athleticism. It could be anything, you know, but why would you give up on yourself? You know,
that's awesome. I don't have kids, but I imagine being up on that stage, that gives you such an edge over everyone else that isn't maybe utilizing that and they have it available, or maybe they just don't have anything to relate to.
Oh, it's so empowering, man. It's a huge advantage, I think, that I have when I go into situations like that.
It's like a warrior mentality, you know, like you're a warrior out there and this is battle. You know, you're swinging your bells, the other guys are swinging their bells, and you're doing this for your family. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Let's go the other way. Like that's kind of channeling, you know, things to motivate you to success. How do you deal with failure in the sport?
Well, I get very reflective. I start thinking about what could I have done differently. I don't, I'm not the type to get upset with myself or start down talking myself in any way. I don't try to like spiral into any negative feelings, but I assess. I think, you know, what was the variable that caused me to drop early, to not make the number that I needed? Is this something that happened over a span of time, or is this something that happened in that day? Maybe if I had to cut weight and I had dropped too much weight too soon, I felt depleted going into my set. Maybe I didn't prep my bells as far as chalking or anything else that I needed to do. Maybe I didn't work as much on conditioning and I just focused on getting stronger over the months in preparation for the event. So I get analytical and I start figuring out what was it that threw me off. You get upset, you definitely get annoyed if you missed it, and you had plans and you know that you maybe could have gotten it done. But I think just like be in the emotion, process it, and then don't allow it to be a hindrance and just be able to move forward from the next opportunity you have going forward. So that was maybe day 100. You have day one right around the corner, and that's the next day, and you start getting ready for the next competition, whenever it may be.
Yeah, you can either learn from it, and grow, or let it continue to be something that holds you back.
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of things are you doing in terms of with coaching? Are you also taking athletes to these events? And what's your coaching style? How does coaching even happen at a competition? For kettlebell, I know like with weightlifting, I'm in the back helping people with their warmups, little technique things if needed, and then counting the numbers. I don't know if there's like a numbers table or like you're declaring a certain number of attempts. How does the coaching aspect work for you at these kettlebell events?
Well, it's similar in the sense of like the role you play when you're behind the scenes, when you're behind the curtain, making sure your athlete is safe and they're doing all the warmups and everything that they need to do. There isn't a declaration of numbers at the beginning of their set, but there is a plan that you might have ahead of time as far as like this is the pacing that you're going to be going for. This is the numerical goal that you're aiming for at the top of the set. Don't let your nerves make you get ahead of yourself. So like you don't want to go in there at the beginning of a 10-minute set with an all-out sprint and tire yourself out prematurely, because it's only going to lead to you failing at your set. It could be, from a coach's perspective, reminding them what they're there for, what is it that they want to accomplish. Maybe it's the first time doing it, so don't get too caught up on the numbers. Get caught up, maybe just really living the experience of enjoying what you're doing and reminding them that they decided to do this because they want to have fun, or because they enjoy pushing themselves, or maybe they're there because they want to prove something to themselves, whatever it really may be. And then if it's somebody who's doing multiple events, like in the case of a biathlon, which is a jerk event of 10 minutes in duration, and then a snatch event of 10 minutes in duration, you might be the guy who at the same time is keeping track of their cumulative numbers to make sure that they have enough points to qualify or to hit that quota that they needed to get a rank. Or if you're thinking about from the perspective of a performance coaching, when the person's actually on the platform, you're reminding them to breathe, you're reminding them of relaxation, of holding the bells overhead long enough to be able to get the point. If they're not picking up on the feedback the judge is giving, then you relay the feedback to them. And it could be hold the rep longer, it could be slow down, it could be whatever the case is.
So that's great. You can talk to them mid-competition and you can be like, hey, if I'm out there, you're like, James, you need 5 more clean and jerks to qualify. You're like, keep going, Oh, I think we have technical difficulty. Yeah. You hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah,
okay.
I think it's a call coming in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so what I said is it's great that you can talk to them. And like, if I was your athlete and I was out there and we're trying to qualify for something, you can be like, and you're keeping track of the total, you can be like, James, you need 5 more swings. Like you need to keep going, and keep me abreast of where I'm at in the overall competition.
Yeah. Well, if you were the competitor, I would want you focusing just on your platform, your clock, your judge, and whatever feedback I'm giving you. But maybe in the back of your head, you're thinking there's 2 other guys to my left who I'm competing against, and I don't want to fall behind them. So I have to kind of pull the reins in to make sure that you're focused on your actions and not the actions of others that you have no control over, because you're not going to make the guy stop early just because you're willing it to be. So yeah. I might be the one expressing to you as I'm looking over at his side, like you're good, keep going, or maybe you need to pick up pace, or you can slow down, because I'm seeing that maybe you're starting to get a little tired and I want you to endure versus go all out and then have to drop early. You're playing the role of manager, you're playing the role of confidant, while you're there. There's multiple hats you have to switch on, when you're coaching somebody who's at an event. And I also, one thing that I've learned, I think over time as a competitor, is that I pick and choose my battles. So if I know I have people who are going in for big important sets, I'm not going to put one of my own sets in that same competition. I'm not, because I need to be able to devote my time to my athlete versus trying to ration everything out amongst all the other people.
Yeah, that seems like it would be very difficult. Well, it is very difficult at any event, trying to compete yourself, while your athletes are going, especially during the same session.
Yeah, definitely.
How do you warm up someone or even yourself for, let's say, like the clean and jerks, where you're going to get over 100 reps and the weight is 232 kilo bells? how are you warming up for that? Like, how do you approach like not doing too much in the back and jumping up in weights?
Well, I try not to do warm-up sets that are too lengthy in duration because I don't want to tire myself out. I focus a lot more on doing shorter rep sets for more frequency. So I might do a minute worth of work and then drop and walk around for 2 minutes, maybe do a little bit of a band accessory work to get my rotator cuffs nice and primed, go back to the weight. And I'll start light. It'll be the equivalent of empty bar work before going up for your first set. So I'll start with a pair of 16 kilos, single arm work, do a couple of reps, include the second bell. And once I feel like I'm warm, then I'll jump into the next bracket of weight, which is gonna be 16 to 20 to 24, 28, 32. And if given the opportunity because of accessibility, I might do a little bit of overload work where I grab a pair of 34s or 36s just to get a feel of the weight in that rack position to help me settle down. That way, when I go back to my 32, the 32 doesn't feel as daunting and as challenging as it normally would.
I like that. That's an approach I've taken with many people on like squats. Yeah. Like if you're going for a squat PR, you'll do a walkout set where yes. it's way in excess of what you're planning it's to hit genius. For a PR. It. You just feel the weight on your back, walk it out, hold it for a few seconds, walk it back in, and it kind of tricks the nervous system a little bit.
Exactly.
And also just, you know, the muscle between your ears. That's a part of your nervous system, but also...
That's the biggest one. That's the
most important. Yeah, it does a lot of other stuff. So let's bring this back to barbells somehow. How can weightlifters utilize the kettlebell to get better at weightlifting?
Well, if you think about the barbell weightlifting is a very sagittal movement. You know, for the most part, you're very linear, but there's always those rotational forces you have to compensate with. There's always those asymmetries you have to worry about. I like the use of kettlebell lifting as an accessory to weightlifting because you have unilateral work that can address those imbalances. So if you happen to be weaker, tighter, less mobile on the left side, and you know that's affecting your catch position when you're in a split jerk, then you can address that by doing the unilateral work with the kettlebell. And you're still getting a similar training stimulus if you're thinking about what a one-arm jerk would end up giving you in comparison to the carryover we would have with two arms on the bell. But you're getting the accessory work. I mean, most people tend to not to think about the hypertrophy and the accessory work that you get because they get so caught up in like the skill work of it. So they do all their barbell work or all their kettlebell work, but they don't think about how rows and squats and everything else, it plays a vital role. And in this sense, if you're doing kettlebell training as a complement to your weightlifting, then yeah, the inclusion of unilateral work or doing things where there's a unilateral element, even though you have both limbs working at the same time, causes you to now have to create this individual stability within these two center of masses over your head. It's very different than I'm not gonna say the luxury, but having the option to pull apart on a barbell and create stability by stacking it over your head, you know, the way you would if it was two independent masses. Yeah. I personally find it harder to stabilize a 140-pound barbell over my head versus a pair of 32 kilos.
Yeah, and that makes sense. On, you know, I mean, you see, it's very common in weightlifting, you know, especially if lifters are only doing their training with a barbell and they're not mixing in, you know, like dumbbell work or, you know, maybe even just some basic gymnastics like push-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups to develop those imbalances. And then you just kind of start to accept after a while, well, I've got my weaker side and then I've got my stronger side or I've always got this hip pain, but you could fix it with something like a kettlebell even it just like focusing more like for rehab purposes. Like how would you go about rehabbing, let's say someone's shoulder hurts, you know, they've got some kind of impingement in their shoulders. How would you utilize a kettlebell to rehab that?
Well, I'd look for a range or a load within a movement that creates a pain-free environment for them to be able to explore. So if they know that holding a dumbbell overhead hurts every time they do it, then what does putting your arm in an overhead position without, in the absence of a load, feel like? Are you able to move and position yourself pain-free? Once you've got that, then we can start including the bell into it. I mean, most people tend not to hang enough, you know, so just doing a very passive hang from a bar might be helpful for the sake of really feeling a sense of security within the rotator cuff. I like something as simple as just a waiter's walk or some type of overhead walk where, you know, you have to take that tool. You're not doing various repetitions. You're finding that groove of a nice steady position that feels pain-free and you're stabilizing it and you're building strength endurance over time, which then does have a carryover with you being able to hold and stabilize that bar as an athlete. So if it's just a rotator cuff work, might be a matter of softening the tissue up with a little bit of lacrosse wall work, maybe doing some activation work with a band, and then doing a set of waiter walks along the length of a turf before you actually start going into your skill specific work.
So do maybe add in, start adding in some of these types of things before you start to pick up the barbell. Yeah. And maybe just warm up in general. You know, don't just hop on the barbell and start snatching.
Make sure you take time to warm up.
That's a tough thing, you know, for many weightlifters, is just to not just dive in there and start adding weight on the bar.
Well, and like, you know, people go in there thinking that you're going to win a gold medal for a warm up, and it's not the case, you know, like, so because of that, like, you know, they just, you know, jump right into going into their heavier sets, and they want like that to be like the glorious thing, tactic of the workout. Warm-ups to play a big role. You know, you have to be able to prep yourself for the work that you're going to be going into. You know, if you don't prep properly, then you're more likely going to hurt yourself.
Exactly. Now, do you utilize any exercises like Turkish getup?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. And you can create a complexes based off a Turkish getup. If you're short on time, like I love Turkish getup into a snatch, Turkish getup into multiple presses as you're ascending upwards into the lift. Turkish get up where there's a snatch and a change in direction on switching to the other hand. I love the fact that it's an expression of strength and stability all mixed into one. And you also have to be mobile enough to be able to change into these varying positions.
That, you know, you're exactly right. And about a year ago, I went a little Turkish get up happy on the programming at Albany CrossFit. We were doing it at least once a week in some capacity with a dumbbell, kettlebell, even barbells, just working on the skill. And what I noticed was definitely people who were not able to get up at all off the floor. They could not roll. They could not coordinate their body to do it. Couldn't keep the straighter leg straight. It would pop up in the air. Mm-hmm. They were all of a sudden hitting PRs of like 35 pounds, 45 pounds. And that's a big jump in a small time frame of about a month, just on getting the basic strength. And then what we started to see was in their other movements, they were doing better on things like snatches. And I could only attribute it to the high level of concentration and patience you would have to do a Turkish get up correctly, transferred over into a snatch very nicely, where now you're a little more meticulous on your movement for that. And you're a little more coordinated, and it just, I feel like there's some kind of relationship. Someday, maybe I'll do a study on it, on the benefits of the Turkish getup for weightlifting.
Well, it's a great movement that I think is engraved in us from the earliest experiences to when, you know, like our dying day, for to an extent. Like I look at my kids and I think about their development when they were trying to first explore movement, and they had to develop those neck extensors and develop spinal extensors and push themselves up. And what did it look like when my kids first stood up, when they first were able to pick themselves up off the floor? It wasn't as structured as like what you know, RKC or anybody teaches as far as this is what a get up should look like, but technically they were getting up off the floor, and teaching somebody to get up off the floor in a safe manner that's efficient for whatever task they have to do is the key thing in this. So I think my love affair with the Turkish get up is that it's applicable towards a child, towards a combat athlete, towards an elderly client that you may have. Everybody would benefit from the use of that, because it teaches you to really, really hone in those elements of proximal stability so that your trunk is creating a stable platform for you to express movement from. And by having proximal stability, you can go into that distal mobility and be able to move the shoulders and move the hips and make adjustments, because a get up really encompasses a lot of, and not just to throw sexy words out, but I love the word proprioceptive vertical. It forces you to have to now keep that implement in your hand or whatever that may be, vertical to the ground, and forces you to make adjustments around that object, whatever it may be. So if I'm holding a bell, that bell has to be vertical to the ground. Otherwise, it could fall on my face. And one thing I tell people all the time is the floor is not going to go anywhere. So don't look at the floor when you're doing the getup. Keep your eyes on the tool, because the tool could hurt you if you don't have a good relationship with it. Stay connected to what you're doing, you know, throughout the entire duration of your set as you're going through it.
No, I agree with all that. And I think it's everything you just said could be applied to weightlifting and getting better at snatches and clean and jerks and having good balance. I like that cue, the floor isn't going anywhere. I've heard other cues out there that I won't repeat on the podcast, but that's always a thing, people looking down at the floor.
Well,
one more question for you.
Yeah, sure.
Your hands must get so beat up on doing these kettlebell sports with doing 10 minutes or 30 minutes of so many lifts. And I know that's a huge part of weightlifting too. Like you have to take care of your hands. And a lot of people don't take care of their hands and they don't realize how much that affects their performance. What do you do to keep your hands fresh and in a high capacity?
Well, I make sure that when I'm actually in the midst of a lift, I'm using chalk for the sake of making sure that I'm not over gripping the bell, because the over gripping causes a lot of friction, which leads, in my case, of tearing of my hand. So I like using chalk like Viking Performance or other brands that just give you like a nice soft platform. It feels a lot like you just got the brake pads changed on your car and you're about to go on the road trip. Like you feel more confident when you're doing your sets. Mm. As far as my own hand maintenance, what I tend to do is I'll either file down my hands or I'll use some type of shaving tool just to eliminate the calluses that seem a little bit raised, because I don't want them to start catching as I'm doing my sets. And when you fatigue, you'll start choking on the handle a little bit more, and that leads to a little bit of a tighter grip. And that's easily how you can develop a blood blister on your hand or tear or something like that happens. And if I'm in the middle of a competition, I'm not looking for the tear, but it's kind of acceptable if it happens there. I don't want that happening during regular training cycles, because it's going to hinder my ability to be able to perform in my training sets. So filing down, I try to use some kind of like fatty balm, like I'll use like Burt's Bees Farmer Solve or something to that nature, which is, it helps nourish the skin of my palm. My wife's also an esthetician, so she's also constantly like throwing things at me, like products I don't remember the name of, but like I'll use them on my hand, and it tends to help with avoid tearing. And also just being responsible with your own usage. So if I know I'm putting chalk on my palms because I want to have a level of friction so that I can grip into the bell properly, let me be reasonable and make sure that I've washed that chalk off my hands before I commence with the rest of my day, because it sits there and it dries your skin very badly.
That's a great way to put it. Be responsible with your own usage. You know, like take care of the equipment, take care of your hands, take care of everything else. Do you do any kind of like manual therapy on your hands? Any kind of rolling with like a ball in there, any massage?
Yeah. I like the yoga tune up here. They make a really nice pliable ball. I show you one of the ones I have here, but what I like doing is just a bit of palm massaging with one of these guys. So put it in the center of my palm. It pretty much looks as if I'm doing CPR on the floor, but I'll roll and try to get the tissue within my hand to be as malleable as possible, that the metacarpals end up releasing and I have a little bit more freedom. I also do some PNS stretches on my finger just to get things to open up a little bit. And then I also do extensor stretches and strengthening movements to counter some of the excessive flexion that I do. I might just put my hand into a B shape and then put a rubber band around my fingertips and work on finger extension. And that just helps counter some of the possible carpal tunnel I could develop from over flexing all the time.
You know, that's fantastic. That's definitely something that the average weightlifter or just, CrossFitter is not doing probably. Is one, rolling out those hands, but then doing things like actually stretching out the fingers, pulling them back a little bit, and doing some kind of extensor work with like even just a rubber band. Like you can buy things that'll hook onto your fingers, but
yeah,
a rubber band will
probably. Rubber band is a trick. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Like how many reps would you do just like until it fatigues or just like just throughout the day?
Point of near failures, I might push like 88% effort, 92% effort, something to that degree, where like I feel like another couple of reps I might get to a fatigue point, and then I'll just let my hands recover and do it throughout the course of the day. I don't look for something that's going to be too resistant, so I want to be able to actually open my hand, and if I'm looking at rep ranges, I might do something within like 15 to 20 reps of opening and closing my hand, and yeah, maybe like 3, 4, 5 times throughout the day, depending on like when my next training set ends up being. I usually tend to start doing that immediately as soon as I finish my workout. I'll be in the middle of a coaching session with like rubber bands on my fingers and doing like opening beak exercises.
No, that's great. You know, cause like weightlifters spend a lot of time in that overpronated position too. Everything's the same, exact grip for all the movements, even squats, deadlifts, unless you flip over a hand. I think that's great. I spend a lot of my time with my online coaching with this little guy here. It's a bar, a little mini dumbbell stress ball. So I watch the videos,
that
I
do the
programming, and I just squeeze this thing. Because I don't know if you can tell, I got way more gray hair than I do when you first met me.
Oh, dude, I think I've gotten a lot more like white hairs coming in the last like 3 or 4 weeks of life.
Oh yeah. It's been an experience.
Yeah.
Well, Juan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been great.
Oh, brother, my pleasure.
Learning from you and learning your history and talking about your experiences. Hopefully, people will be able to to pull some of this kettlebell knowledge and apply it to their CrossFit and weightlifting, because I think it's just so valuable.
Oh, I love working with CrossFit athletes or anybody just generally who's curious about it, like upping their game in whatever way possible. I've helped CrossFit athletes go, you know, just feel more confident within the scope of whatever their workouts have been, and it's been a great experience. You know, I love coaching. It's one of those things, like, I take a lot of pride in what I'm doing. I get a lot of enjoyment, a lot of like fulfillment out of it. So yeah, I mean, anytime I can help an athlete from, especially from different sports, you know, at the end of the day, it's we're siblings, you know, whether you're a weightlifter, yeah, or a strong man or anything else, you know, why not take care of a brother or a sister, you know? So I love getting messages from athletes from different sports who are like, hey, you know, what you do looks interesting. How is that applicable? I'm like, fuck yeah, of course it is. You know,
yeah, try this. Yeah, 100%. That's why I wanted to get you on the podcast, because I was like, you know what? Kettlebells, dumbbells, barbells, like you said, you know, Atlas Stone, we're all one big family. We just, yeah, have different focuses, you know, so it's great to take care of one another, and you can certainly learn from one another. Well, Juan, where can people follow you?
Well, I'm on Instagram at UR Strength. So that's letter U, letter R, the word strength, all one word. And you can go there to see like all the antics as far as what I do with my family, training videos, coaching experiences, competitive dialogue. And I'm also on Facebook. Full name is Juan, J-U-A-N. Last name is Pejot, P-E-L-L-O-T. And I'm also going to be upping a lot of the information and the content that I'm putting out there, just to make people feel like they're really getting the most out of the experience when they connect with me.
Awesome. Well, definitely, guys, you know, make sure you follow Juan. And maybe we've inspired some people, too, to participate in the sport of kettlebells. And maybe someday there'll be more kettlebell clubs out there. I mean, who knows? Maybe Albany CrossFit will have a kettlebell club, because we have barbell club. Maybe that'll, yeah, be something we do in the future too. I mean, that'd be pretty awesome. Make sure everybody that you follow the Barbell Strikes Back on Instagram. Follow me, James A. McDermott, on there as well. Make sure you head on over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. Leave us a rating if you think we deserve it. And thank you again so much for listening. Juan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, sir. And thank you to your listeners. I really appreciate it.